The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. Okay, so 27th of May, 2020. I'm in Edithburg on York Peninsula, here chatting with Christopher Tatchell. Thank you, Chris, for participating in the RSL Time to Celebrate. Could you state your name, date of birth, and your service number, please?
My name is Christopher Stuart Tatchell. I was born on the 4th of May 1952, and my service number is 45275, which was the Department of Defence Army. Okay, as I said, I was born in a place called Dorking, D-O-R-K-I-N-G, in the county of Surrey, England, to my parents, Aunt Tony Tatchell, and my mum was Doris Erica. Her maiden name was Jay. She was the third daughter to a schoolmaster called Henry Jay, and Henry Jay was actually a warrant officer in the Royal Army Artillery Corps in the First World War. I've actually got photos of him in that. My father was an apprentice in the English Merchant Marine Navy. He actually did the England to Russia and served virtually in all areas in the Merchant Navy, where those ships were, I suppose, directed to go. My mother's background, military, is she was actually a driver for the Royal Army Service Corps. Not exactly in World War II, right at the end of it, she was posted out to a place in Egypt, like a peacekeeping role. My childhood. Didn't even really know Dad. He was never home. About every 18 months he'd come home from sea, and I knew then I'd be either getting another brother or another sister. You could tell time the clock on it. I'm the oldest of six. So three boys and three girls, I'm the oldest. And we weren't a very well-off family. Most of my life, most of my childhood, was in caravans. I only lived in two houses. Before we came to Australia, I only ever lived in two brick houses. One was in Wales, where Dad had come ashore for a year, and he was the coast guard at a place called Rasilli in Wales. And the other time, my youngest brother was badly hurt in a car accident, and I would have been around about 11 or 12 at the time. We were living in a place called Cinderford, and we moved to Gloucestershire, and we had a council house, and Dad became skipper of a 300-ton barge, which used to be called the BP Miller, which used to run flammable liquids all around the south end coast of England, up into Swansea, which is part of Wales, etc., etc. That's my childhood. Really, isn't really much to write home about, because there wasn't much to it. It was a pretty hard existence, especially with Dad never being there. So I suppose in one way I became the surrogate father to my siblings, for want of a better word, and helped Mum out that way, to the point where Mum actually wrote to the authorities in England, and I was granted admission to what they called the HMS Arethusa, which was a four berth training schooner for wayward lads, or lads that come from a poor background, or they were, yeah, I suppose in Australian too, behind the eight ball as far as disadvantage, not physically, but just with life as it was, if you like. And I was going to join the Merchant Navy from there. I went there at the age of 13. I went to the HMS Arethusa with the aim and the goal inside of joining, following my father's footsteps and joining the Merchant Navy when I graduated from the Arethusa, which would have been at the age of 16. But Mum and Dad and made the decision that they would come to Australia. Now, I would have been, I suppose, 14 and a half years. I went to Arethusa at 14, so yeah, around about 14 and a half years, and they are old. And they said, look, you can either stay at the Arethusa or you come with us to Australia, but we're coming anyway. We're coming to Australia. So I thought, right, this is right. There's nothing to keep me in England. I said, no, I'll come. And I remember coming down the gangway here in Australia and thinking, right, this is now the start of my life. I'm going to turn everything around. And I did. And don't get me wrong, my father and I, it was like the young bull and the old bull. He'd come ashore. You got him, as I said, I never even knew my dad growing up. And suddenly he's there, and I don't know whether he was resentful of the fact that I was close to my mum because of the way I had to be to help her run the family, or whether or not, it would have been his schooling, because, I mean, the man of the house is the breadwinner, and he's in charge, if you like. So, yeah, we moved to Whyalla, and I got a job there. I lied about my age, and I went to Moalana.
What year did you arrive in Australia? Was that you were about 14, you
said? About 14, so it would have been around about 52, 62, about 64, I suppose. Yeah. We arrived, I think, in the year that the pound had gone on the dollar, like decimal currency had come in. So I think that was around about the 64 mark. So I lied about my age, and I got a job at on a station out at Moalana. So I was 14 and a half, and I told them I was 15 and a half. Near 16, and they took me on, and then the things fell into place, and they realised that I wasn't the age I'd said I was, and because it was an apprenticeship that was funded by the government, their hands were tied. They couldn't continue with it, if you like. So I went back to Waiata. I got a job as a dockhand, 15 years old. I went to work for Brambleslea as a dockhand, 16 years old. I got my B-class licence and A-class licence, all in the same month, if you like, because that's the way Australia, South Australia was. So B-class was a car licence, A-class was a truck licence. And Dad and I were still locking horns, so at the age of 17, I joined the Army. That was in June 69. And I was discharged in July of 89. After serving 20 years, and I was discharged with the rank of Warrant Officer Class 1, which is the highest rank you can get in the non-commissioned ranks.
Can you recall how you felt? Was it an exciting time of your life?
It was a great time. It was time for me to go out and make my own way, in my way of doing it, and I enjoyed the Army. The Army and I, for the first 6 years, we had a love-hate relationship because I wasn't smart enough at that stage to realise that the Army will allow you to bend the rules, but they won't allow you to break the rules. And I wasn't doing too bad until I came back from Vietnam. And me and a lot of people were going off the rails, if you like. It was just a totally... After you come back from Vietnam, what you were before you went and what you were when you came back were two totally different people. And it's fair to say, and you can put this down by all means, fair to say that when I met my wife Helen, and that was in 73, if I hadn't have met her and married her, It's fair to say, and this is not in any ways big note myself, I'd either be dead or in jail. No two ways about it. That is a fair dinkum fact. She was my best mate, my best friend, and she was the one who was the reason that I changed my outlook on life, and from there the army and I just got along famously. I actually came into their way of thinking without losing my identity. I just was smarter, if you like. And yeah, so I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed every. I wouldn't change a day of my 20 years in the army, even the good and the bad and whatever. The first six were probably the hardest, but that's because I was probably still finding my way and still young enough and arrogant enough to think that it was my way was the best way type thing. And yeah, and the army, well, they were fairly smart.
Could I ask you to have a think and share any examples of what you're describing? Like the first 6 years you said were the hard years?
In the first, right. I joined in 69 and went to Vietnam in 71, early 71. In 70 I was up in the Northern Territory with the same platoon. We were a petroleum platoon. We were field force, which meant that anything out in the field to do with the refueling of all equipment, be it aircraft, fixed or rotary winged, any type of mobilisation, be trucks, vehicles, bulldozers, anything at all that took fuel, we would build the establishments to refuel them in the field, if you like. Hot and cold refuelling in the Army and Air Force equipment, that was different. For example, cold refuelling of a helicopter is when he's parked on the helipad and you've actually got the nozzle into his fuel tank and you're filling him up, okay? And he's everything switched off. Hot refueling is when you're doing exactly the same thing, but his rotor blades are turning at just short of liftoff. So that if anything goes wrong, he's gone. And you don't get any warning. If the nozzle goes with him, the nozzle goes with him. And it's the same with the aircraft. It's hot and cold refueling. It's different when you've got all the blades turning. And you're still refueling him. So that is different. And we did that in Vietnam many a time, hot and cold extractions and refueling. I spoke to you about where I was breaking the rules rather than bending the rules. When we came back from Vietnam, most of us had a drinking, what you would call a drinking problem. In other words, we drank to excess, we stuck by each other, we looked after each other, but we only looked after those that we were there with, if you like. We had respect for other people who had been to Vietnam, but the unit I was belonged to, it was a platoon strength, about 30 strong, and that was it. So you're very, very close. When we came back from Vietnam, me and my drinking habits, I managed to get myself banned from driving in civilian life completely down the eastern states, Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria. Went DUI in all three of them, which the army didn't take kindly to. And at the end of my about five and a half years ago, my officer commanding called me in and said, you're up for re-engagement on your sixth year. The army will not be re-engaging you. So that's it. You're time to part company. And I said, no, hang on, woo. I said, I've changed. I'm married now. I've got a son. I'm quite happy to do the right thing. They said, mate, you've been given chance and chance. It ain't going to happen. So I went away, and I was a corporal at the time. Two hooks on me. So I went away and spoke to my wife, Helen, about it and whatever. And So I went back to them and I said, okay, I said, to show you that I'm fair dinkum about wanting to stay in the army, how about if I hand my stripes in and I'll revert back at my request to being a private again? And that should prove. And the OC came back within 24 hours and he said, yep, he said, the army are quite happy on those conditions that you will be allowed to re-sign at the 6 year mark. I'm to reduce you in rank today. I thought, well, that didn't take long, did it, Skipper? But we did that. But the army, they were still smart. What they didn't say was they were also going to post me. So out of the unit that I belonged to, which was 30 strong, they posted me and the wife and the son right up from Pagapunyal in Victoria up into Holsworthy in New South Wales. Never been to New South Wales in my life. And it was to a 21 supply battalion full of ordnance people, which is another corps for want of a better word. But it's a supply corps, it's not fuel force. It's, in my eyes, it was a massive step backwards. But the army, in their wisdom, had thought, we're taking him out of the platoon he's in, and we're going to see now if he's going to keep his word or not. That's where I hit rock bottom. They sent me to a place called, they sent me to a unit, or a part of the unit was ammo platoon. And I was standing at this trough, and I'm sorting out empty shells, like 7.62 rifle shells, the casings from any that would have the bullets still in them. And I'm thinking, Jesus, wept almighty, I said I was firing these 6 months ago, and now I'm doing this. And I really, yeah, I thought that's certainly the lowest point ever in my life, I think. And I went home, and hey, the wife reckons I broke down and cried and whatever. Then it's funny, things in life, something will change, and sometimes it's for the worse and sometimes it's for the good. This one was for the good. The bomb disposal, which used to work out of Paddington in Sydney, their OC, a bloke called Major John Blair, his driver had taken real crook or whatever. Now, I already had all my army licenses and everything else, had them, and I got seconded to him to interim drive him in and out of Sydney whilst this driver that he did have was supposedly recouping or something, whatever was happening with him. And that was the change of it. I got on very, very well with him because he was the first bloke that actually took an interest in me, if you like, as a soldier. And his driver never came back. And I was actually posted then as his driver. I was posted to bomb squad unit in Paddington, Sydney, as their bomb disposal driver. And I loved it. And he had a lovely wife called Agnes, who him and Agnes became very good friends with my wife and my kids. It was like they adopted us. I was still a private, and he was still a major, and there was never ever a change of that. I always called him Sir, and he always used to, well, he would call me Chris or Private if there were other people there. But that was the start where, when he got posted from bomb disposal, I was posted back. I was promoted to corporal again and posted back to transport in 21. Then I was promoted to sergeant and posted to the Royal Australian Army Ordnance School at Bandiana, which is Wodonga and Albury. I mean, Wodonga's in Victoria, Albury's in New South Wales across the river. Bandiana was a military establishment on the outskirts of Wodonga. And I became an instructor there, went back to my trade, which was as a petroleum operator. And from there, I went through the ranks to become the Row 1 Training Development Warrant Officer for my trade, and which was petroleum operator, and was the authority to all three forces, Army, Navy and Air Force, on any matter related to fuels, oils, lubricants, that sort of thing. I've taught Navy people ship-to-shore refueling. I've taught aircraft refueling equipment, which was Army equipment. I've gone up to the Oki Air Base and taught them how to handle this stuff. So, yeah, and that's why I was discharged. I was, discharged as a Row 1. You know, I've condensed 20 years, and I've left out a lot. Otherwise, we could sit here for hours. I mean, at the Rail Centre as the Row 1, I was very good friends also with the RSM, the Regimental Sergeant Major, who was a Row 1 as well. In his absence, I used to step up and take and do his job for him. I was the Regimental Warrant Officer. It wasn't the RSM, but I was a Regimental Warrant Officer. So, yeah, I've got... Once the Army and I more so me, once I learned how the army worked and what they expected and what they didn't, I didn't find it hard at all. I think in the first 6 years, it was probably the army being like it was in them days, probably was reminded me also of what my father was like, and that's probably why I rebelled. But yeah, but a lot of it, I'm not laying it all on the army. A lot of it was my stupidity also, and my, along with the majority of us, the inability to settle down back in Australia when we came back from Vietnam.
Can you recall some examples of, as an instructor, maybe recognising characteristics with the soldiers you're training up?
My word. Yep.
Like, that must have held you in great stead.
It did. It's a great teaching curve. I know what positive criticism is, which is, look, you're wrong there, but you're on the right track, and if we do this, we're going to get there. Negative criticism being, you're a dickhead, you don't know what you're talking about. I know how to write course reports. I've written reports on people. And the old saying, to thine own self be true. I mean, it's no sense in writing things that aren't true, but there's also ways of handling people who have got shortcomings and working your way through them. There is also the ability to recognise that sometimes people are not going to change, and to then perhaps have to make hard decisions that have to be made in accordance with that. But on the other flip side of that coin is also the recognition of people who are doing a good job and making sure that they get the accolades that they deserve as well. So, yeah. But you don't get to be away one without being in charge of soldiers. So, I was answerable. Poor geez. I was answerable to whichever unit I was in. I mean, it was a colonel at the Rayot Centre. I actually have a letter somewhere from a general who wrote to me commending me on my outlook to the army. That was because when the wife and I was posted from the Rayot Centre on promotion to Staff Sergeant, and we were posted to Brisbane. And I wouldn't have been in Brisbane 2 months, and I was detached back to the unit that I had just left, which was the Rayot Centre, so I could keep on instructing and supporting their courses down there. And in the space of, I think it was, I was up there 3 years, in the space of 3 years, I was detached no less than 10 times. And each time was for a minimum of 6 weeks. Didn't weigh me none, but I also recognised the fact, though, that would have put extreme hardship on the wife, because every time we got posted, it's the wife that has to look at a new area and new schools and new bus routes and all this sort of thing. Where the soldier, well, by the time I got to be a sergeant, I already knew a lot of people. I could be posted to a unit, and I knew half of them anyway. So, yeah, it was easy, but, yeah. So, and the divorce rate in the armed forces in them days, horrendous, really was horrendous. But if you got yourself, if you were lucky enough to get a good wife, as I said, me and the wife, we would have celebrated. I would be celebrating my 46th wedding anniversary this June, and both still together. No one else. It's which is a rarity these days.
That's a very good point about the effects of all the reposting for Helen, and. I mean, did she ever say to you, maybe it's time for a change, or...?
No, me and the wife, Hutch and I, when we first met, and we agreed to get married and whatever, and she knew I was in the army, and I said, look, when we got to the 10-year mark, not of the wedding, but of our marriage, but a 10-year mark of me being in the army, okay, that's when you look at yourself and you say, well, now what am I going to do now? Because if you go over the 10-year mark, you're actually on the downhill run then to the 20-year mark. To explain that, to get your superannuation in the army, if you did 20 years effective service, then whatever, and the army was compulsory superannuation from the day I joined, whatever you were put in, they would match. A very great superannuation scheme, but you had to do 20 years to do it. So once you got past the 10-year mark, you really had to ask yourself two questions, which would have made me 27 at the time, 27 then. Do I want to get out and get a job while I'm at a really employable age still? Or do I go through to I'm 37, which will guarantee me the army superannuation, which wasn't enough to live on, by the way. You still have to go and get a job. But you're 37 then, which is, you're not so employable then. But once you made that decision, yeah, you ran for it. The only time I remember we sat down and we discussed it would have probably been around the 10-year mark. What are we going to do? And there was no disagreement on that at all. Because we were public servants, even though we were in the army, we were public servants under the government, the scheme. It was called the Defence Force Retirement, DF, Defence Force Retirement something board, to do with superannuation. You can't even get that now. Now, I remember going to a resettlement seminar as a WO1 about three months before I was discharged. And went down there, and you do this resettlement, and they bring people in. It's to ready you for civvy life now. Don't forget, I've been 20 years now in the for services. So they introduce you to people like union officials. And the army don't have unions, so they'll introduce certain people to you. And this one fellow got up. He said, I know that the police force have a superannuation scheme similar to yours. And a lot of you people think that they're lucky because the police were allowed to take out a huge lump sum and they could go and buy their house. He said, yours doesn't work that way. You can take out enough to, I think you could take $30,000 out, which would give you a decent down payment on it, a deposit on a house. He said, but let me tell you, he said, this superannuation scheme you're in, which is CPI'd every year, is yours until the day you die. You will be paid till the day you die every fortnight. And it'll be CPI. And he said, and if you die, if your wife is still alive, she will get 3/5 of it until the day that she dies. He said, now, you just work it out. He said, to join a superannuation scheme like you're in now would cost you millions. And he was telling us this in the start of 1989. So the army, the whole superannuation scheme was changed around about, I reckon, in 1990 they changed it, and now people in the army, they have to wait until they're 65. In other words, their superannuation is identical to anyone else's in civilian street as to being able to access it, for want of a better word. Which took away then that argument or the debate at the 10-year mark, do I soldier on to do 20 years or not? Well, that equation disappeared, if you like. But the more you stay in the army, obviously, the more goes into your superannuation, which is there waiting for you when you're 65. Yeah, I prefer the scheme that I was in, but a lot of people that were probably 5 or 6 years behind me, when it came out, they could elect to either stay in, they were still serving, they could elect to stay in it or change to the new scheme. But after 1990, once you joined, you were in the new scheme. That was it. There was no...
That was the threshold.
Yeah, that was the threshold, yeah. Mm. Yeah. For people who were offered a commission and accepted it, now, I didn't tell you that. When I was at WO1, in my last year, I went in to see the old man, the colonel, and I submitted my resignation. And said, it's 20 years, it's done me time, whatever. And he said, well, that's a pity. That's a pity, mate, because he said, I'm recommending you for PSO. PSO used to be what was a short acronym for Prescribed Service Officer. If you were recommended for it, you said okay, and then your head of corps accepted and said it's going to be enacted, on the 31st of December of any particular year, you'd be a WO1 or one or two. On the 1st of January, you would be a captain. No lieutenant, you would go to the rank of captain, and your pay would stay at least at the same level as what you were as a WO1. In other words, if a captain was being paid less than you at that particular time in your service, yours would stay as your WO1. But it meant that you weren't an NCO anymore. You were now part of the officer corps. You would have to leave the sergeant's mess and go to the officer's mess. From a superannuation point of view, excellent. Oh yeah, good money, superannuation point. From a personal satisfaction point of view, a lot of people I knew did it. And I've got to be honest, there's not too many I know that were happy in the end that they had done it. Because as a WO1, you are at the top of your tree. You don't look up to no one. No one above you in the NCO rank is above you. You are at the top. You're highly respected. You are the best at what you do. To change streams, for want of a better word, and become a captain, the only person below you is a lieutenant. Everyone else above captain is above you. In other words, you're now in the junior part of the officer's rank structure. 99 out of 100, you would not be retained in the same trade that you were the expert in. Suddenly you become an admin officer. You'd be something totally different. And also the stigma of going to the officer's mess and having a majority of the officers, or a lot of the officers, would be looking down on you only because you've become an officer by rank of just being promoted into that position, instead of having to go to the officer's school, like say Portsea or Duntroon, qualifying to become an officer. So yeah, it was, I remember him saying to me, and I said, look, with respect, sir, nah. I said, don't even submit it. I'm more than happy where I am. I've done my 20 years. I'm the best at what I can do with my 20 years that I've done. It's about time I got out now. And I was very, very lucky also, unbeknown to him, Linfox Transport had headhunted me. I had a job to walk out into. I'd already gone and done the interview. No disloyalty to the Army. Went down for an interview. After the interview, he sent me home to speak to the wife. The job's mine if I want it, working out of Adelaide as their operations coordinator. Oh yeah, four of us WO1s got out of all at the same time. All different trades, and the time had come and we all had jobs. Two of them had a line of work that they were following up, and two of us had jobs to walk into.
How often would that role of warrant officer one come up?
In my trade, only one. There was only one. The same trade that saw me ham my two hooks in so I could stay in the Army at the 6-year mark was the same trade that I got promoted to as a warrant officer class one 12 years later in that same trade. So that's how the wheel turned. So going from the bottom of the heap, I ended up being right up on top of it. And it was a lot of it was hard work. A lot of it was an attitude change by me. And in the Army were more than happy with my output. And I didn't change. Sometimes the army had weaknesses too. One of its weaknesses was that if a bloke was no good, they'd promote that bloke and send him to another unit and let someone else look after him. It was a bad weakness on the Army. There were a lot of people that were actually had rank that really shouldn't have had it at all. But they were an opening had risen somewhere and there was a gap and we can get rid of this bloke from here. Let's promote him and get rid of him. So, but to answer your question, you always knew when someone was going to get out of the Army, and it wouldn't be a case of if, it would be a case of when, because they would start talking about it. They'd start talking about what's on the outside or that sort of thing. So really, and you took very much, you took notice of what it was if it was in your unit, because you've got a vested interest. So, but you had to be honest with yourself as well. If a bloke came up and said, look, sir, I'm really thinking I'm going to take discharge because this is what's been offered to me. Although you're loath to see him go, And I mean that because he's going to be really, really hard to replace. If you're honest enough and you can see that what he's being offered is a very good deal, and it's probably worth his, would be worth his while to pursue that, then yeah, you've got to support that. If you can see the flaws in it, and he's looking at it through coloured glasses, and he's failing to see the pitfalls as well, same thing, talk him through it and explain. But in the end, the decision is still going to be his in the end. Yeah. A lot of blokes got out of the army because, and I speak to a lot of them now, and they're still of the same view. They got out of the army because the wives made them get out. Don't like it in the army. Kids don't like it. Yeah, I don't like it. Either get out or we're going to get divorced. A lot of the blokes, 15, 16 year mark of their army career, were, there's two here in Edithburg, got out because their wives told them to at the 16 year mark, 17 year mark. And yeah, they're 3 years short of doing their 20 years. But yeah, when your wife is saying she's going to leave you, it's a bit hard to say to a bloke, yeah, but you've only got 3 years to go, mate. And then you get, I mean, the wife's not going to wait around for 3 years. Suddenly, what advice can you give a bloke when you really can't do anything at all because it's his wife calling the shots, not anyone else. So, yeah, all you can do is just sit them down and give them your honest point of view. And, yeah, that's all you can do.
A lot of your roles through your time in service then is very much it's dealing with people and characters and negotiation.
You're a mentor half the time. The army is, because the army is one big family. And whichever part of the branch of the family you belong to, you become mum and dad sometimes. Especially if you're doing, as we used to do, when I was a WO2 sergeant and then a WO2, we would do the petroleum operator courses. Now these are for the soldiers who have just come out of RTB, Kapuka, and this is now their first step to get qualified in the trade within the army, if you like. And you're teaching these, so you got to understand now that you're now dealing with 17, 18 year old boys. They're not men yet, they're still boys, for want of a better word. So you've got to, and look, some people, I mean, you're an instructor, and the instructor is an all-embracing, you become their go-to. They come to you, or you go to them, if you like, but it's their part, they're your unit, they are your responsibility. You accept that I'd already done the interview with Lynn Fox, I told you that. The job they offered me was the operations coordinator out of Birkenhead, Adelaide.
How long did you stay with Lynn Fox?
I stayed with Lynn Fox from 89 to 96. And then in 96, Alan Scott headhunted me. He'd taken on the Santos contract in both Moomba and Jackson Oilfields. Jackson Oilfield being southwest Queensland and Moomba being up the top of South Australia in Minka Way. And I went into the field then as his field manager on a 2-and-2 basis, 2 weeks in, 2 weeks out. And I had to get that up and running. Again, I don't know why I do it to myself. Again, new drivers, new job, totally new set of rules. But again, I had the trade knowledge. Knew how to get the best out of people. And then 2002, Vietnam started catching up again. I started to not go off the rails, but I started to become introvert and whatever. So I went and saw Vietnam veterans. They got me an interview and I got made TPI in 2003, which is totally and permanently incapacitated as a post-traumatic stress disorder. And you never know when it's going to catch up with you. But yeah, she caught up. Well, see, it depends, because a lot of the people were, when they came back from Vietnam, they took discharge, and suddenly that they weren't part of a family that perhaps could look after them a little bit better. At least I did my 20 years in the army, and when I had off days, I had people around me that had also been there, and we could talk and whatever. Of course, when I got out, suddenly that disappears, if you like. If the wife was sitting here with you, she'd sit there and say, you never spoke to me about it at all either. I only speak about it to people that that I was with over there, if you like, for want of a better word. Yeah.
So how tough has it been?
When I came back from Vietnam, with the I was lucky in that I came back from Vietnam with the unit that I was with in Vietnam. So unlike a few fellows who came, because we used to go over on our own and come home on our own, all right? And when you came home on your own, a lot of the fellows, when they left the unit, they'd be posted back into the army system somewhere, and it could be a brand new posting with brand new, you know, not knowing anyone. Because I came back with the unit, we actually closed up Nui Dat and then closed up Vung Tau. I actually came back with the unit. 10 of us came back as the unit. And we got posted to Inogra in Brisbane, part of 5 Transport Company, which was our company over in Vietnam. So we knew a lot of people. So we were like the same family, if you like. We weren't trying to learn a different job with people we didn't know. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of people go off the rails, is because it's just...
too much change.
Just too much. They've got no one to talk to. So we were right there. It was, as I said, the thing that worked against us was, look, we still worked hard, we knew our jobs and whatever, but it was... yeah, who gives a rat's ass? We've been there, done it. It's not like you had a death wish, but you didn't really care. It was whatever happens, happens. And and the army, unfortunately, and they've still got that, they've still got it today as well, is they failed to recognise the signs that were being displayed by a lot of soldiers. There was probably still the old and bold, they'll get over it, if they stuff up, punish them, that's the way to do it, punish them, whatever. So, as I said, I was very, very lucky in that by meeting Helen, I actually had someone that I could talk to and listened, not about what I'd done, because I never discussed it with her, but it was someone I could talk to, it was someone that I cared about apart from myself. That's probably the better way of saying it. I had someone that I really, apart from me mates, someone that, I cared about and whatever. And as I said, the second break was the bomb disposal major. For want of a better word, I use the word adopt, because he virtually adopted me. Because he obviously saw something in me that previous people hadn't seen when I got posted to 21 Supply Battalion. So, yeah. So has it been hard? I still have days. I have bad days sometimes. But all I do is go for a walk or something. It's you learn to run with it. But do I sleep well overnight? Nah, not really. Still not. It's just part and parcel. But do I enjoy life? Yes, I'm finding it very hard at the moment with the loss of the wife, because she was my best friend. And I'm lonely now at times. But they're the cards that have been dealt to me, and I've got to play with them. I've got to play the cards as I've got. So, I have better days. I have a lot more better days than I have bad days. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the wife and I have known, and we've known heartache. We lost our youngest daughter to anorexia. My second daughter was involved in a fairly horrific car crash in 2002. She's in Adelaide. Yeah, she does it hard at times with her pain. But yeah, I've got a son, eldest son. He's doing all right. I've got 2 grandkids. So yeah, and there's always someone worse off somewhere. So yeah, I'm all right.
If I can just finish up and say thank you very much, Chris, for talking with me today and sharing some stories. All the best for the future, and thank you once again.
You're probably the first person that I've given that yarn to about my childhood and everything else, right from woe to now, if you like. I don't remember ever having this. I mean, other people would know bits and pieces of it, as I, you know, depending on where I've been and what we've been talking about or whatever, but you're probably the first person that I've done an abridged version of this is your life.
Thank you very much.
No worries, mate.
Good on you. Thank you, Chris.
Nice work, Robert.
You have been listening to the RSL A Time to Celebrate, 2020.